So I'm sure the last couple of days were quite interesting, and I'm really sorry I couldn't be here. I'm teaching 110 students class, so I hope you're going to forgive me. But I'm very happy that I have a chance to present this talk. It was quite an unusual departure for me to start with, so I think it's interesting to, in this meeting, present the history. I'm aware of the fact that there are two groups here, mathematicians and social scientists or specialists in criminology. So this group here that did this work is actually quite a diverse group. Dennis Gorman and Paul Grunwald are both in the field of drug and alcohol abuse, specifically alcohol abuse, sociologists and a psychologist at Texas A&M and the Prevention Research Institute up at Berkeley. Carlos Castillo Chavez, an applied mathematician now at Arizona, and his group, pretty large one. Lee Remmer is also with Paul. So there was a mixture of people that got funded by Dr. Karen Peterson at NIH, specifically at NIAA, to actually try to do mathematical modeling of the effects of, the system level effects of alcohol abuse. So the trend in alcohol research today is to try to look for genetic predisposition to abuse. And that's a great endeavor, and there are animal models on which you can actually do that kind of research. However, even if you have that result, even if you have a gene that predisposes you to take 3 or 5 or 7 drinks a day, the effect of a person that has that particular genotype, its phenotype is actually affected by the environment that person lives within. And so the system level understanding of how people interact with each other and how does perhaps abuse of alcohol propagate through the community and ultimately leads to effects such as violence was the purpose of this particular research. So to jump to the end of my talk, for the criminologists in the audience, I'm going to try to convince you that while the models cannot tell you exactly what's going to happen at any given point at any given time, and I didn't have to tell you that, you know that in advance, I'm going to try to get you to pay attention to models. So that's how much I'm going to try to attempt. Because I think they're saying something interesting. Even the very, very simple ones that I'm sure I'm going to get shot down on really badly. So they're going to question my assumptions tremendously. But Dennis and Paul are not here to defend themselves, but they are directly within the field, and these are the assumptions that they, as social scientists, gave to us. But I'm sure everybody is going to question the assumptions. I'm going to try to tell you that the models actually are showing something interesting. That's for the criminologists. For the mathematicians in the audience, I'm going to try to tell you that there is something interesting about the mathematics of these kinds of models that I don't think we tapped into yet, or at least we didn't tap into in a big way. There is a large, nice space of theorems that exists and no one has done anything about it. So with that having said, I can go home. Okay, yes, I did work with my wife. And there was a lot of shouting at the beginning because she's in social science. And we don't shout at each other normally, right? But we kind of came to terms with our opposing views on the same subject.
And I'm not a mathematician.
Yeah, she's not a mathematician. So we came to terms with our opposing views on the same subject and did some work that I'm going to present to you next. So we were supposed to develop analysis tools within this program to help identify high-impact preventive and or treatment actions. This is obviously marketing, right? Obviously, we would like to have a set of tools that would allow you to predict what, in this case, I'm going to call climate. It is the context of weather versus climate. So I can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow in LA, but perhaps I can predict what is going to happen if we change a neighborhood and reduce the number of bars in the neighborhood, so change the environment somehow. So the idea is many years, not 50, but 4 years, large-scale climate of crime. The requirements are capture the dynamics. And dynamics here is going to be quite important. There is a coupling here between dynamics and statistics that I hope, as I go on, I'm going to reveal. A little bit more technical, but worth looking into. And capture the essence of system-level interaction. The idea being that the individual actions, however coarse model they are, might lead to some system-level dynamics that is actually reasonable. So that's what I'm going to try to convince you of. We have many examples in physics in which this is the case. The temperature in this room can be perfectly well predicted from a very, very simple formula, right? While the individual motion of any atom is completely unpredictable. So the belief here is that while humans are extremely complex as beings, that perhaps their behavior, because of the fact that part of it is affected by the genotype and part of it is affected by the environment they live in, as an aggregate, actually is predictable at some scale. And that's another keyword that I'm going to use later on. So not an individual, but a scale, a lot of different people. This is a trend. And so for anyone who is in social sciences and has been following this literature, well, for bioterrorism research, agent-based modeling has sort of taken to be the approach, modeling approach that one can actually take in this context. So here is one paper in PNAS, and then there is a whole set of papers in Proceedings National Academy of Sciences in 2002 that is actually a very good background for what I'm going to talk about. So this is a trend, it's not something that we've done and are isolated in it. Now, what do you get? If successful, you get a virtual city sandbox with which you can play. Say you are within an agency that is interested in what kind of changes in environment can lead to changes in system level interactions. So how much crime you get, what is the spatial distribution of the crime, right? If you're such a person, you would like to be able to test different strategies, but you definitely don't want to test it in real life. Impossible, right? So you're not going to tear the block down and say, let's see what happens. That, of course, happens, but you cannot do it on a massive scale with very different experiments, right? You can just say, you can predict something, say, I'm going to do this, and then let's see what happens. And so this gives you an ability to actually simulate the city. Many of you maybe have kids who play that game Simulated City, right, where you're a mayor and various actions. So this is something like that, but hopefully based on much better social science assumption and interactions between people. And then, if you're successful and convince the people who really care that the results in this virtual city sandbox are giving you something reasonable on a large scale, then you can actually develop mathematics and software for what is called rapid analysis in design. If I give you a software that you can compute the situation in the city and it takes you 50 years to compute what's going to happen, you're not going to like me, right? Yes.
Just real quick, what happened in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina, would that allow almost give you the virtual city sample?
Sure. You mean can that be modeled?
Yeah.
Let me give you an example, and that actually a lot of people are thinking about as we speak. The evacuation from Katrina, in the context of Katrina, was botched. I mean, it was horrible, right? The resources were not utilized, the planning was not there, it was just terrible, and the capacity was underutilized. So one specific example, and that's on my next slide, in which you can do modeling with agents. It's just people in vehicles going around and perhaps not interacting with each other, just going, transport, right? We have that kind of a system. That's a Los Alamos-built TransSims that actually tells you in green here a street on which the traffic is low, and then in red a street on which the traffic is high, based on some assumptions on what people's driving habits are. So you can actually have a whole city topology built with artificial cars running around at the street, figure out how much the thing changes. You could then derive good strategies for redirecting traffic in parts of the city and actually do that as perhaps even an active control mechanism where you are looking at the traffic with the cameras, counting how many cars you have where, and you have signs that actually direct you to various parts of or various loops that are less congested than the others. That's definitely the idea behind TransSims, and I put it out here because that's actually quite a successful development that Los Alamos has built and is now is actually free. You can download it and simulate it if you want. It's capable of simulating the second by second movements of every person and every vehicle through the transportation network of a large metropolitan area. I'm not going to show you anything like that. We don't have that, but I'm going to show you a coarser model that does something like that. So what can be done with this? Let's suppose you want to model a disease outbreak, right? Someone comes in with something bad, and then person-to-person contact transmits it through the whole city. The dynamics of the epidemic is going to depend very strongly on what the topology of the transportation network looks like, right? Because people meet depending on where they go during the day in the city. And people have done that, and actually there was a paper in Nature just last year that simulated the epidemic of smallpox in Seattle, I think, or Portland, and made some conclusions on how such a thing could be prevented. I was told by the head of epidemiology at Singapore that they actually ran an agent-based model that told them how the epidemic is going to spread while the SARS epidemic was going on, and he claimed that they basically ran the model real time, and they would cordon off the parts that they felt they would have a possibility of an epidemic spreading out of. Now, of course, Singapore being autocratic as it is, they could actually cordon off parts of the city. I'm not so sure that it would work anywhere. And also, this was the man who implemented the system. He was claiming success, so, you know, all these caveats aside, they had some success in implementing these models in real life for real time control. And there is a variety of other applications. The protagonists here are vehicles and people. And you can describe the movement in either a probabilistic or a deterministic way. What this means is I can either say a person is walking from here to there with certain probability, and that's what I'm going to do when we introduce these alcohol models. Or you could say the person sits in the car here, and there is a very deterministic way at certain speed, you know, velocity at which they propagate forward. So there are two different types of models that you end up with. The essential similarity of what I'm going to talk about and this particular one is the topology. The roads, the topology of the city actually makes quite a bit of difference as to what happens there. So here are some more detailed goals, right? Develop the agent-based models for prediction of transient and equilibrium features. I'm going to talk about those. Develop analysis tools that help you explain these features. I'm going to talk about those briefly for the mathematicians in the audience. And understand policy implications. I'm going to tell you what happens when you remove bars in specific ways from the city and try to see whether that coincides with some intuition that we have. And then we are actually going to take real data from, in that case, Houston, and look at what the spatial distribution of crime looks like based on the distribution of bars and alcohol abuse in our model. So we're going to try to look at real data and then run the model and then compare the two. And as I said, don't expect me to have, you know, 10 to the minus 6 agreement between the two, but you might find some interesting aspects of the problem being revealed. Okay, so let's go through some of the technical details of this. Does anybody recognize the city here? Yes? Sacramento? And the bars in Sacramento there. And so what we... what is in green and yellow and red is actually the distribution of the population in the city. So what we are going to do is take a city like this and then split it into boxes and basically say, because we are coarse graining, we're looking at larger scale than just individuals. And then we are going to put those boxes on a lattice. And to start with, I'm just going to tell you about a one-dimensional city to play a little game and to see what kind of aspects come out and what I can conclude from that. And I'm going to progress to two dimensions and then I'm going to end up with real cities. But doing this preliminary step is important because I get quite a bit of intuition as to what my system is going to do. You know, just running a simulation and basically saying, well, this is what happens, doesn't necessarily give me a lot of knowledge. It gives me information. Information is different from knowledge, right? It gives me a point of information, yeah.
Number of individuals at site, do you mean that they live there or that they are at a certain point in time
okay.
available? There?
So at the beginning, we are going to distribute the population according to where they live later on, right? So they actually live there, but they will move. So let me actually go through this. So number of individuals at site I who are drinkers are denoted by D of I. So there can be 5 or 10 people in a block that actually have a property of being drinkers. What does a property of being a drinker really mean? So this was a huge debate at the beginning of the project, and it turns out that in this part of social science, there are actually three coarse categories, and these are the people that drink more than, I think, 7 drinks a day, 5 drinks a day, that would be in this category of drinkers, and then the recovered, so these are the people that actually used to do that, but are not doing that at that point in time, and then susceptibles, these are the people who are casual drinkers, like pretty much most of us in this room, I guess. But don't drink more than 5 drinks a day, right? So. Sorry?
At IPAM, we're all in DOI.
Brutal honesty. All right. Okay, so let's start with everybody in DOI and then see what happens. All right, so obviously you could stratify the population based on the number of drinks, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. You could do it based on age. I'm going to throw away all of this. So you're going to see that there is a lot of stuff that is just not modeled. It's not there. But we'll try. Let's see what happens. We're going to have movement as well. So if a person is on this side here, they can move to the left, my left, or to the right, with certain probability. Now, when I introduce bars into the system, let's say this is a bar, then the drinker is going to move towards the bar with a higher probability.
Sounds realistic.
Okay. So far, so good. So in that case, P1, which is the probability of moving towards the bar, is going to be bigger than P2. And the rest of them, the recovered and the susceptibles, don't care. They just move around as they want. And I want to mention that, you know, one step to the left or to the right, it actually means it is something on the order time scale, is on the order of one day. So what I just mean by this is the person actually moved to a spot. Of course, they're going to return back. We had a remark from one of the people who looked at the paper and said, their model generates probabilistic homeless. Okay, I don't need to model the fact that the person is going to the place and then going home and sleeping, right? Irrelevant for the context. It still got published, so the editor actually dismissed the remark. All right, so. Here is a slide for what the approach really is with these. So I define a model, right? People can walk left and right. They can go to the bars with preferential probability. And so what would we really like to do with this? Well, here's the virtual lab. That's what I'm going to show you. It's a city with certain rules of transport inside the city. You can run the simulations forward, and you can get the results. How many drinkers at which spots? That's your result. What's the fraction of drinkers in the city? What is the violence in the city due to drinking? I'm going to show you what is the assumption for that. Right? So the world, well, you're going to get data. Data exists. So between the world and virtual lab, you're going to have to do some statistical analysis whether your data corresponds to what you've just computed. Theory should be, if I want transients, dynamical systems theory of some kind. It might be some sort of coarse graining. I'm going to talk about it in just a second. But all these three play a role, and there is a feedback between all three. And you cannot avoid that feedback because the problem is too complicated. You cannot just run ahead too much without actually going back to the data and checking the data. Using statistical analysis, but the statistic has to be, in our context, spatial. It needs to care about spatial features and dynamical features. So both dynamics and spatial context is actually of importance. So lumped statistics can inform our models, but I can't compare the models just based on lamp statistics. They're going to capture it, no problem. The problem is, do they capture dynamics? Do they capture the spatial features? So for mathematicians, the model is a spatially distributed Markov chain and is spatially inhomogeneous. Topology plays a very strong role. So when you see something like that, there are tons of problems that immediately come to your mind. You would say Markov chain, I'm talking about transition probability matrix, that's going to be exponentially larger than the number of your sites. That's bad. You can't do that. So if you have Kirchhoff dimensionality, you have very long runs to equilibrium. You have to do Monte Carlo to average. So every time you run to equilibrium, you're going to have to do it over and over again in order to get some results. The saving grace could be the continuum description. What is really killing you is the spatial inhomogeneity in the continuum description. You can write it down. I see. Andra can write an equation. It's just writing down an equation. I'll write down some equations. And then the key here is really what is your scale of observation. Below certain scale of observation, you can't do anything. It's like trying to predict the weather in Boston. You can predict it in Santa Barbara pretty well most of the time. But in Boston, I had the impression that you can predict, you know, Santa Barbara, weather prediction, problem. Then I moved to Boston. It was different. So scale observation, extremely important. Okay, so let me show you some results. These are results for the one-dimensional lattice. So what I have is a lattice with sites. We distribute 5 drinkers, 10 susceptibles, and no recoveries at the beginning, and then you distribute people like that. You start getting them to move and mix around, and they interact using the following rules. A susceptible is going to look around and see how many drinkers are around, and how many total people are around. And then, based on the proportion of drinkers that are around, so his environment or her environment, take the ratio, multiply it by some constant, and convert to being a drinker. Based on that, or if gamma s is bigger than 0, you don't need any drinkers around, you're just predisposed, and you just like drinking, you go to the bar, and you drink more than 5 drinks a day, which is your cutoff, right, to become a drinker. So there are two aspects of interaction, well, two aspects of human condition that are modeled. One is peer pressure. The other one is the genotype. Only two. Nothing else is taken into account. If you're drinking, and there might be certain pressure to stop drinking that is independent of peer pressure. That is, you are working, and your work suffers because you're drinking. That's not peer pressure. That's actually external, just kind of average pressure to stop because you cannot perform. So it's not you talking to people. Also, there are legal measures that can force you to stop drinking in a variety of ways. So regulatory measures, right? If you're recovered, that doesn't mean that you're going to stay recovered always. You have a certain probability to start drinking again, based not on peer pressure, just based on the fact that that's what you want to do. And then the other part of that is you look around, there are a lot of people drinking, you're in that situation, and you start drinking again. So that's the only thing that people interact with. So very simple rules of interaction. What does that lead to? It's a simple model. If there are no bars, everybody who is a susceptible pretty much after a while is going to start drinking. Everybody who is the population of drinkers after a while settles at a certain value, and then the population of recovered also settles at a certain constant value. And this is, if you do mathematics, this is what you would expect from this model exactly. People are not leaving the population, they're always staying the same. There is an interaction between a variety of people. The mixing is perfect, everybody talks to everybody else, and so at some time, there is going to be just the people who drank at some point in time or not. That's too simplistic, too naive. So let's go and see what happens if you introduce a bar in the environment. And then something anything interesting happens. Because, so if you're a mathematician, you would say, well, you introduce a bar in the environment, but everybody's still talking to everybody at some point, because they are still moving through the city, and they are interacting, and so sooner or later you're going to run into a bar, and there's going to be seven people there drinking, and you're going to start drinking too, right? So the logic is, shouldn't change much. Well, it does, and so we ended up calling this the shielding effect, and as far as I remember, there was actually an experiment like this in Baltimore that I'm going to tell you about in a second. It didn't work very well. So there is some basis for this. Even this simple, simple model, people are walking on a linear lattice. So what happens is, if you introduce a bar right there, what this is the population of drinkers at various sites. If you didn't have a bar, the population of drinkers would be pretty much distributed. People are drinking at homes. So, you know, there are some drinkers here and some drinkers there. It would be distributed over all the sites. But you introduce a bar, the drinkers like it. They go there. They hang around other drinkers. And they don't affect a lot of the population around. So it's shielding. Your population of susceptibles goes down to some constant level, and then it doesn't drop further. So all the math people in the audience are going to say, well, it's rubbish. If you wait long enough, it's going to go to zero. And you're right. It's a finite Markov chain. It has a finite probability of dying. But this was another observation in the referee's reports. And yes, when you calculate how long it takes 60 years with this particular parameter. So not very important. For the mathematics, actually, this is quite interesting. It's a metastable state. And it actually depends very strongly on initial conditions. If you have a uniform distribution of people in the city versus people distributed realistically in the city, it's going to be quite different, this metastable state. So it's not an ergodic equilibrium. It's actually a metastable state that I think is quite interesting. And the shielding effect, of course, in Baltimore, that's exactly what they thought at some point in time, that if they introduce sort of these enclaves where they could attract people with these tendencies, that maybe things are going to get better because shielding, it introduces a bit of a problem, right? Because the crime rate just exploded locally and it just ruined the whole situation. So this model it tells you there is shielding. The shielding happened. That particular theory, that was a predecessor of this model. No modeling for that, right? But there was a real life situation like this. The problem with it was crime exploded. So yeah, true, people would go over there, but then the crime actually ended up affecting the whole city. So not a good thing to do at home. However, it leads you to, we had an impression that this was something interesting. So we looked at Sacramento with its real population, and we got some distribution of drinkers based on the bars and the population. And we wanted to analyze, so this is a sort of a typical distribution of bars and where the drinkers would hang out. The susceptibles would slowly diminish, and in the suburbs, you ended up having a lot of susceptibles, not too many drinkers. In the inner city, you got a lot of drinkers and not too many susceptibles. This is just a slide to point out that different initial conditions are going to lead to different metastable states, so one should be very careful to use the real population of the city, not just the uniform. So in mathematical modeling, actually in this particular case, the initial conditions actually become very important. And here's a couple of graphs that I thought were quite interesting, because they tell you something, they start telling you something about policy, right? You can play now with this. Take a city like Sacramento, and this is what all these plots are, and vary the number of bars. You can distribute them in a periodic fashion, you can distribute them in random fashion, and they just plot the fraction of people that end up being drinkers in this metastable state. So in this case, not everybody becomes a drinker. There are a lot of susceptibles that are hanging in the suburbs and not drinking at all. The most interesting part of the curve is this. If you have the number of bars exactly zero, people drink at home, they actually mix with each other, and the population of drinkers becomes substantial. You introduce a couple of bars, you go to this metastable state when the population of drinkers actually drops. That's this dip here. And then you start increasing the number of bars, and it starts jumping up. Now, I will show you towards the end of the talk that this distribution of bars actually does correlate with real data on assaults. So 911 calls. So if you believe that data that you haven't seen yet, then you would say that cities that are kind of to the right here, that have this number of bars, that depends on the size of the city. This is not universal for every city. But if they are there, you know, decreasing the number of bars, reducing the licenses, reformulating the neighborhoods, it's not going to help much, because this is the number of drinkers, and it stays pretty flat until you reach this sensitivity curve when it drops down. That sensitivity curve has a logarithmic profile, something interesting. And there are here are two cities, Anaheim and Bakersfield, and these are these artificial curves, and you're going to see that Bakersfield actually is lying in a section that is not very healthy. It's to the right, so you can change your policy quite a bit. You can reduce the number of licenses you give, and things are not going to change much. However, Anaheim seems in a better situation if you are to believe these plots. This is just for convergence results. If anyone is interested in technical details, I'll show you. So, here is the virtual sandbox part. Yes, question.
All right, are we actually going to come back to the mechanism of shielding? I'm unclear of what it is that's actually generating the shielding. Is it the bias random walk that's doing it?
Exactly. Yeah, so the bias random walks makes people visit, well, and in real life, this is actually
true.
There's
less complete mixing.
There is less complete mixing. It introduces a metastable state that sits there for a long, long time, and you get the shielding effect. Yeah, that's exactly right. So now you can start playing and say, well, what happens if I'm somewhere here and I start reducing the number of bars in the city of Sacramento, bars are in red, and see what your drinker fraction is. You want to reduce the drinker fraction to as much as you can. You can never reduce it really to complete zero because recoveries actually go back. But so random removal is right here, right? Lateral removal is here. Removal from the center is there, and outskirt removal of bars is actually there. So you see that depending on how exactly you remove the bars, it actually matters quite a bit. You might be staying in the flat part of the curve, or you might be dropping quite substantially. And I think I said something wrong.
What's horizontal versus lateral?
Oh, I'm going to show you on the next slide. So this top here, that was one of my major points, is actually random removal. If you just go and randomly pluck stuff out, you're not going to do too much. However, if you do something clever, and this is lateral, see, the city of Sacramento has these bars that are layered vertically. And if you start removing things vertically, you actually get a great effect. I mean, you're dropping down pretty fast. Now, random is this. Outskirts is that. And horizontal is this. The idea of just removing the sufficient number of bars to get a lower fraction of drinkers is not exactly the right one. Because imagine that you have a huge cluster in the middle of the city, and you start removing from there. Well, the problem is that these bars have enough capacity, so people are still going to go there, enough people are going to go there, and that cluster of bars actually acts as a single bar. So the topology of the distribution is actually very, very important. Okay, since I've been told that 45 minutes is about what I should have, so I only have a few minutes, I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. But what you've seen before is individual distribution points on a lattice. And now we wanted to look at whether at some scale we actually get a reasonably good prediction of what the spatial distribution of crime looks like. So to give you a simple idea as to why you should be looking at the scales that are neither the full extent of the city nor the individual point on the lattice, here is how it works, right? If you're looking at the individual point on the lattice, you're looking at a block. People are moving in and out, there is a huge flux, essentially everything is random. So if you actually analyze what is happening there, you're going to get a lot of information, but your ability to predict is nothing. So your information is zero, and your information is very high, your prediction is low. So as you increase the scale, so you go to the scale of the whole city, over a year, the fraction of drinkers in the city is not going to change substantially, unless something dramatically changes, right? You introduce a law you introduce prohibition, right? Then in that context, things are going to change very, very substantially. But if nothing changes, At the largest scale, you're going to have a lot of information, prediction ability, you're going to know exactly what's going to happen next year, but you're not going to be able, you're not going to be getting a lot of information either. So what you want to do is look at some scale that is in between the scale at which everything is random and the scale at which you can make perfect predictions. And that's the scale at which you have useful information. On that scale, usually the fluctuations are kind of deterministic, and then you have small fluctuations around them. There is a way to predict this, but since I predict this scale, but since I don't have too much time, maybe I'll leave it for later. And so this is kind of my last slide, but it maybe summarizes and gives you an idea of what can come out of these kinds of simulations. So this is Houston. I think 3,803 bars.
What a challenge!
It was a large. I didn't actually talk about the size of the simulation. There's quite a bit of coarse graining and things like that that happens here, that is the underlying machinery under this. But here is the population. It is filtered, so I want a scale at which I can actually make some predictions. So it is aggregated over a certain scale. And mind you, the census, usually in geoinformatics, you do the census track and things like that. These are actually blocks that are square blocks. It turns out that that actually might be a better idea for the reasons that I can happily discuss in the discussion session. So this is your population. It peaks there. This is your bars. It peaks there, around 150. Here is your picture of assaults, 911 calls from the police. They're actually not in this particular data linked to alcohol per se. They're just violent assaults in the city. So real data. And then here is the output of the simulation. And while at first sight they might not look very much the same, if you look at the features, look at that peak, that's somewhere there, and look at that peak, that's here. And then you have three peaks here, and that's here, here, and here. And then you have something in the middle that is a peak, and that is an artifact of the simulation. You have to take it with a grain of salt. On the other hand, it is neither like the population distribution, nor like this distribution of bars. It is actually, in some sense, the combination of the two. And if you think intuitively, that's kind of what you would expect, right? Where you have a lot of people, you have, let's say, a few bars, you still have a lot of people. So there is, statistically, there is a larger probability that you're going to get some violent assaults there. If you have a lot of bars where people, some of the people with perhaps violent characteristics actually attend. I've been told by Paul Grunwald that there is a bar in Sacramento in which five of the most dangerous of the captured serial killers in the last 30 years used to hang out. I don't know which one that is, but don't go there. So the point that I want to make is that you have these peaks on the left and you have these peaks on the right. And they're actually a combination of the population and the bars. And you're actually getting a qualitative agreement between the simulation that includes incredibly little about the real human interaction, right? I mean, if you look at the rules of behavior, they're very, very simple. But you're getting some kind of an idea that perhaps that's what happens. And I'm going to stay away from the notion of causality, right? For all the social scientists in the room. I'm not going to get into that pond. So I don't claim any causality one way or another. The only claim here is that very, very simple models can actually reflect the spatial statistics of crime in a city. That's the only claim. And so that's pretty much what concludes my talk. We published a paper in American Journal of Public Health on this. We believe it was the first paper on this sort of stuff. There are some policy implications that we can discuss back and forth that come out of this. I think the most important message that I took from this was the Houston situation. Oh, by the way, we did Sacramento and San Antonio as well. We're doing 27 other cities right now. In all three that we've done so far, the violence that as reported by 911 calls, mind you also you can do You can do reports from the hospitals as well for violent assaults. They show the same structure, which is if you have bars and you have a population in the city, these two things combine together to tell you what the spatial distribution of violence, violent assaults is going to be. So the models show you a picture that is quite similar to the one, not quantitatively the same, and we don't expect that, right? These are social science models. But qualitatively, it gives you the right distribution. And that, to me, was the most interesting, perhaps most surprising outcome of this project. We didn't expect any qualitative or quantitative agreement on spatial statistics when we started. So this was kind of above the bar for us. We expected to try to discover some shielding effect type mechanisms, right? So our purpose was mechanisms. What we ended up with is maybe a little bit more than that. So I'll stop at that. Thank you for it.